DQ presents. Picture this. Picture the new DQ Summer Blizzard treat menu with iconic flavors that taste like instant summer. You order the one and only drumstick blizzard with peanuts. Oh, wow. Crunchy waffle cone pieces, world-famous DQ soft serve, and blue sky bliss. Or maybe you get the brownie batter blizzard. Ooh-wee. Fudgy brownie goodness. You're feeling breezy and dreamy all over. Moments like these are why the new DQ Summer Blizzard treat menu exists. Get it delivered at DQ.com. DQ. Happy tastes good.
Welcome to Cam Chat with Edmonton Sun columnist and best-selling author, Cam Tate. Chat number one. Cam talks with Calgary-based author Ashley Bristow on her new book, My Own Blood, and how her brute determination has given her son an incredible life when so many others could not and did not. Oh, just one more thing. No big deal. Cam lives with cerebral palsy.
Yo, how is your book? How is it doing?
You know, I don't look at the numbers, but I've been told it's on a number of bestseller lists, which is awesome, but I can't confirm that. My husband, Chris Turner, is a journalist and an author, and I've watched him learn the hard way not to watch the numbers, so I don't look at the numbers. But I've been getting incredible feedback from pretty much everybody. I had one man tell me that I had misnamed the river. The only criticism I received is that I misnamed the river that forms the border between New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And then I said, oh, thank you so much. I never want to get stuff like that wrong. I'll change it in the next draft or the next edition. And then he emailed me about 45 minutes later. He's like, actually, I was wrong. You were right. And I was like, okay, never mind. Thank you. So,
Tell me what your first thought was when you drove up to 8801 Staten Avenue. And you saw the gray buildings. What were you thinking?
My first thought was for sure that I was floored by how substantial the campus was. There aren't any photographs, or there weren't at that time, any photographs of the campus on the website. And so I didn't know if I was going to a strip mall. I didn't know if I was going to a hospital. And to get there and to find, to really, it reminded me of the Viceregal Lodge in Shimla, where the British used to move the capital of India from Delhi up to Shimla in the summertime. And they have this incredible castle in Summerhill in Shimla, and it really reminded me of Summerhill, this Viceregal Lodge, sort of crossed with a Seven Sisters campus, sort of like Vassar or Mount Holyoke. I was so floored by how green everything was and how big the trees were. It just looked like a college campus.
Yeah. You took your entire family, is that right?
Yes. So not every time. That first time, we have an older child named Sloan, 4 years older than Alexander. And so Sloan at that time was only five. So, of course, we took Sloan with us. And then it was recommended that we bring another adult with us to take care of our hurt kid, is how they phrased it at that time. So Grandma came. And my mother-in-law is a very good sport, but really didn't know. We didn't know what we were getting into, so how could she, you know?
Yeah.
So I recommended that she invite her sister, who lives in New Hampshire. And so her sister, Mary Elizabeth, came. And then also my dad came, because I think once he saw that we were going to go to Philadelphia, we were renting a house, we were going to be there for 9 days. Mary Elizabeth was coming, Margo was coming, kids coming. He was like, well, I think I want to come. my dad came down. And so it was this huge sort of brigade of us that went to Philadelphia the first time.
Did you rent a house in Chestnut Hill?
I'm sorry, did we rent a house where?
In Chestnut Hill.
Yeah, we rented, like over the years, we've rented three different houses a number of times each. And I've also, so a lot of the people, not a lot, I mean, there's a number of houses in the area walking distance to the Institute that are for rent and set up wonderfully for Institute-going families. They obviously have, it's like a Airbnb situation before Airbnb even existed. And then one time I went down there by myself and I stayed with a woman who I think had been employed by the Philadelphia Philharmonic for her career, was now retired, owned this giant house, and was part of something called Hosts for Hospitals. And this is a network in Philadelphia, because Philadelphia has so many hospitals, people come from all over the region to go to various hospitals, and somebody recognized that this is a huge burden on families to stay close to their loved ones in hospitals. And so they created this, it's literally free, it's like a homestay program, basically, and I stayed with this woman, and she gave me hooks to sleep and hot water, and yeah.
Who gave you meat?
When I was at the Institute?
Yeah.
And worked with?
Yeah.
So at that time, Glenn Doman and his wife Kitty were still alive, and we met Glenn and his wife. Glenn was still lecturing at that time. I think he was 92.
Wow.
He died a couple years later, but he was still lecturing at that time. He was fairly frail, but he could still absolutely, he was a powerful lecturer. He'd obviously done the lecture hundreds of times. He didn't even have to look at the cue cards. And then Janet Doman, his daughter, is now the director of the Institute, and she gave a number of the lectures. A woman named Susan Aisen, A-I-S-E-N, gave a number of the lectures. And then Alexander's Advocate is a woman named Rosalind Klein Doman, and she's married to Janet's brother. And then we also saw Harumi, who's one of the Japanese staff, and a woman named Emma, and the secretariat, sort of registrar woman, is named Harriet.
Yeah. Yeah. Did they put Alexander on Patterns?
On Patterns?
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. So we were trained in patterning at the Institute, and we had tried it at home because we had a book called How to Make Your Baby Physically Disturbed from the Institute that shows how to pattern. So we tried it at home initially, homolateral patterning, so not patterning, but one arm and leg at the same time. And then at the Institute, they prescribed for Alexander cross patterning. And so we came home, and we had to do it 6 to 8 times a day for 4 minutes each time with a 10-minute interval in between. And yeah, we did hundreds, probably thousands of patterns.
Oh, you did, like, how long would it take you to do, say, 8 patterns in a day?
So we would do 2 shifts. We would do a morning pattern, an afternoon pattern, and had different people come in to do those patterns, because, you know, people would come in, it would take them about 5 or 10 minutes to get settled, then we would do a 4-minute pattern, then a minimum 10-minute interval, 4-minute pattern, minimum 10-minute interval, 4 minutes. So you're looking at an hour, and people don't have 2 or 3 hours to come to your house once a week. So we were really asking people to come, do as many patterns as they could. Some people came for the whole afternoon, and then we could get all the patterns in the morning or in the afternoon. We found that it depended on who was coming, and we had to be flexible around the capacities of our volunteers because we didn't have enough people coming, and we had to make sure we weren't wearing out the support that we did have, you know?
Yeah. When you volunteer, did you have?
I think total. It depended at the time, but we had many volunteers over a long period of time. But at any given time, we had maybe 8. We had some people who came every week for a while. It was because it was convenient. For one friend, for example, she did a Pilates class nearby. She would drop off her children. They would eat. They know our kids. They would eat dinner with us. She would do a pattern before and 2 patterns after her Pilates class. And then there were people who came and only patterned once. Like, there were people I pulled in off the street when we were first patterning. People would sign up for the patterning and then not fucking show up. So I live on a very pedestrian dense street, and I was definitely guilty of going out there and going, hi, I need to do this thing with my kid, can you please come in here for 5 minutes? But we had a combination of paid staff who helped and mostly volunteers. And over the course of Alexander's patterning program, we had about 40 people working with us.
Okay. And how many years did you do it?
I did it every single time. I was part of every single pattern.
Okay.
And the other 2 patterners were volunteers.
Okay. How many years did you do it?
We had 3 years.
Okay.
And then once he could run, we didn't need to pattern him anymore. Once he consolidated his run at around age 4, we didn't need to continue patterning him. And we focused on what the Institute calls Environment B and Environment C. Environment A is flat ground. Environment B is uneven ground, like at the riverbank where there's lots of rocks and you can, trip and break your ankle if you're not careful. And we would go to the riverbank every day and spend at least an hour walking over the rocks. And within 2 weeks, we saw his running consolidate so well. And then Environment C is steep ground, having to climb steep environment on his own with no help. And so we would basically put him at the bottom, at the bottom of a little hill, and we started with smaller hills, and then he eventually was grabbing and dragging himself up by the grass, and we did that every day. Please repeat it, sorry.
Yeah, you bet. What was the very first improvement?
Yes. Okay, I got it. So the first improvement that we saw, did you, Cam, receive the oxygenation?
Yeah.
So the masking was something that looked really weird to me. I'm okay, I understand the science behind this. I'm listening to you explain it. I've read it. I get it, but it still looks like you're trying to suffocate yourself.
Yeah.
So I did it in my house, but Alexander was so weak in his chest and diaphragm that he couldn't sneeze or cough, and we heard him sneeze for the first time 2 weeks after we started the masking program. And that was even before we'd fully gotten to the you add one mask a day. And we had only gotten to about 15 masks a day, and we were already seeing that. We also saw him, when he vocalized, he only would vocalize in at the beginning, he was like, And by the end of the first month, he could go, That was amazing! Like, just in the 1 month, he was so much stronger by this targeted neurological pathway development. It was the masking. It's something that you don't talk about very much because, again, it seems like you're suffocating your kids. But it has such benefits that it sells itself to the parents.
Yeah. Many masks a day did you do?
We got up to 40 masks a day.
Yeah.
And even 40 masks a day felt like it was taking over our whole lives. I know that we absolutely should be continuing to mask. And when I was it happens to be in Nova Scotia right now because I'm focused on the book launch, and to have him home, we couldn't, and Turner's finishing a book right now, so there was no way to have Alexander here, and my in-laws were kind enough to have him there. But we tend to do about 15 masks in the morning to get him revved up, and he asked for those masks. And then on most days, we're not doing more than 15 masks. I mean, I can't run a full institute program anymore. I don't have it in me anymore.
Yeah.
And I burned myself completely out. Had we had more support, in the sense of how you talk about how your parents had, sounds like incredible buy-in from their friends and community. We had a different experience with that. I think that speaks to, the individualist leanings of how Canadian society has changed over the last couple of decades. And everybody thinks that they're too busy to help. And
yeah.
Anyway, so I couldn't keep going, and I burned myself out. But we still run, the nutritional program. We run the reading program. Again, we do environment B and C all the time. He finishes his distance every single day. Like, we still run a portion of it. We don't need to pattern him anymore. And he doesn't sleep. Did you sleep in a respiratory jacket?
No.
So Alexander, for 3 or 4 years, slept in a respiratory jacket that patterns his breathing overnight. And it doesn't do anything in his mouth or nose. It just patterns the muscles of the chest. And he loved it. He loved it. But anyway, he eventually grew out of the jacket. And that was fine, because he was sleeping really well.
One more thing I felt. You took to Philadelphia.
Say that again. What about Philadelphia?
One month your last trip. When did you go to Philadelphia?
We went was in 2010. Then we went again, in spring of 2010. Then again in December of 2010. Then in August of 2011. And then in spring of 2012, and then I went by myself in the fall of 2012, and then we went back in 2015, and that was the last visit. They have since had a schism, so the Institute and Janet and the staff have one set of philosophies, and Rosalind Doman, her husband, and their son, Spencer and his wife and some of the staff from India and Russia have a slightly, let's say, less strict. They allow the children to go to school, for example.
Yeah.
They just had a fundamental, sounds like a schism. And they've broken off into two groups, the Institute and then Doman International. And we still correspond with both. I sent a copy of my book to Janet and Susan Aysen, but also to Rosalind and Spencer Doman. So we're schism agnostic, so to speak. You know, like, I think that it's, and I also don't think that the Institute is the only place doing this kind of work. It's just the place that your parents found and that I found. There's other places that believe deeply in the profound potential of children with challenges. It's just not what the public healthcare system or conventional medicine and therapy believe. And I needed something that was outside the norm. It wasn't going to work for me to go in there and have them tell me, oh, you know, bring him back in a couple of years. I think he's fine. He was not fine.
Yeah. Did you get any pushback from even your own doctor?
In Calgary, yes. So our pediatrician is a man named Thiru Govender, and he's an older pediatrician, and I've been going to him, since Alexander was about 5 months old, and he was the perfect match for our family, in that my mom will always tell you, my mom's a nurse, and she'll say, go to an old doctor and a young dentist, because an old doctor will go with their gut, and they know how to handle people. A young dentist has all the new tricks. And he was perfect. Like, he's barely not retired. And we just got each other. The pediatrician that's covered in the book is an asshole who's still employed and was not a good fit for us. But then we found Dr. Govender, and I said, look, this is what I'm doing. Indian South African, and he was like, okay, Mom, whatever you want, anything you want. Yep, I know, I can see you're going to do it anyway, Mom, so I'll sign anything you want.
Where would Alexander be today without going to Philadelphia?
It's almost a gruesome thing to ponder, in that before we had to run an institute program, a self-designed institute program based on the book before we could even qualify to go. So we got a diagnosis and we waited a month to move Christmas time before instituting that. And over that Christmas, he was 8 months old, and like, if you held this child, he didn't curse against you, he wouldn't look at you, he didn't hold on to your finger if you put it into his palm. Like, those are basic reflexes. If you put a finger into a child's palm, they will grab your finger. He didn't do any of that. It was like holding a doll. And everybody said, take it easy, don't push him, don't push yourself. And if I had listened to that, I think that I would have a nonverbal, wheelchair-bound child who had no way of communicating with the world, and I think he would be extremely trapped and angry, and no doubt end up on antipsychotic medication in his teens.
Well, okay, I'm going to ask you one more. How has it made you a better mom?
It's made me, oh my goodness, Alexander and the struggle of pushing against my own ingrained ableism, the baked-in bias of Canadian society, having to face that, and to face the fact that it didn't matter who or what I was before Alexander arrived. As soon as Alexander arrived, and he was a child who required intense intervention, everybody stepped back and was like, yep, that's your kid, you deal with it. It didn't matter, you know, you think you're kind of awesome in the world. I had great work, I had great projects, I had great colleagues, and suddenly I was completely alone, and my older child is gifted and precocious and developed early and walked early and talked early and is erudite and learns most things on their own, and I had been curating my older child's life, but certainly was not in the trenches teaching that child how to hold a spoon and balance the food on the way to their mouth, you know? Whereas having to get right down to the constituent, iterative process part of how to teach this kid every single thing, and then have to repeat those lessons 50 times before they went in, got easier as we went along, but there was a lot of my own ego that I had to break down and build again. And there was a lot of grief around what I'd lost. I lost my mom. I lost two of my best friends to just the fact that they couldn't hack the fear that they had around my kid, let alone what I needed. I had people tell me that if I wanted support, I don't know, I had crazy things told me. I had one man down the street say, you know, you're a bit heavy, you know, I think that you'd be doing better if you lost to the, if you got down to about 110. God. And I'm like, I weigh 190 pounds right now. You want me to lose half my body weight and then I'll somehow feel magically better about having a disabled child? Like,
whoa.
You think people will say to you, they'll be like, you know what, you should get a dog. At that point, I was like, I need a dog, like I need a hole in my head. You know, people will give you the craziest, the nutritional program that we ran for Alexander. People would try to sabotage it. My dad would come over here with an ice cream cone and like
yeah.
into Alexander's mouth. And I'm like, Dad, can you not give my family? Like, please? So, how have I changed? I mean, I'm so much more patient with idiots now. And I'm also quicker to not waste my time on people who can't understand what's going on here. Like, I'm a much better mother to my older child than I would have been. I mean, I think I would have been a fine mother. I was a great mother already. But I'm much more considered because I have to slow right down, and I got broken down into basically madness and have come back with a very clear sense of my priorities and purpose in the world. This isn't what I thought I was going to be doing, and this isn't what I wanted to be doing, but I've produced a book that tells every mother in this situation that they are not alone. I told the most honest, bald, brutal version of the story that I could possibly get myself to type out, because there are so many things we never speak aloud, and they needed to be spoken aloud. And I'm done with idiots. Like, if somebody doesn't agree with what I'm doing with this kid, they don't have any power over me. Most of the people who are paid to deal with my son have no long-term investment in whether or not he gets better. To them, he represents a portion of their paycheck. So I can't resent them for not getting a better job, but I also don't have to pay them or be part of the process that pays them. So I move along. You have to curate your local network life is too short to be surrounded by naysayers or people who don't believe.
My wife is listening to our visit and she is... She loves you. My wife said, tell Ashley I love her.
Aw, thank you.
Okay. How are you put? Do you have 5 more minutes?
Of course I do, yes.
Okay. Tell me about writing the book. What did that do for you? Was it therapeutic or did it drive home the point even more that you did the right thing?
I need you to rephrase that.
Okay. No. When you wrote the book, What did that do for you? Was it therapeutic or did it reinforce that you did absolutely the right thing?
Okay, so a couple things. Number one, it was extremely cathartic to write the book. Not the final draft. Obviously, by the final draft, you're so sick of yourself that you're just like, I don't want to do it again. But the themes were built. Like, I mean, this could have been a 3,000-page book. I had enough material for 3 books, and nobody would have read the second 2 books. You know, like, it's just so much raw material for these books. I wrote a journal and a blog, and I wrote letters, and I just had a lot of raw material. And writing out those themes was cathartic, especially when I combined the raw material and built the themes that became the story that you see in the book. So it was it was cathartic. This book is more complicated than it may appear initially. I wanted to make sure that this was a very Canadian book. I wanted to show that there are people in my life who I wished could be there but weren't. I wanted this book to represent the link between English and French in Canada that we don't discuss very much. I wanted this book to show a marriage. I wanted this book to show my relationship with my older child and how that child was growing up. Siblings are rarely talked about. I wanted to talk about mental health and how there's just not a lot of room for mental health in society, especially for mothers, especially kids, because nobody wants to take on your burden, and they are basically there to shove you away. So it was cathartic initially to write it down, and then once I'd gotten past the, ooh, is this edgy feeling, like, ooh, am I, ooh, look at me, I'm so edgy. Once I'd gotten past that, I got to go into the details of making a book that I wanted to be proud of having been brave. I wanted it to be honest. And in that way, I was afraid very much to talk about my own mother because, unfortunately, my mom comes out as a bit of a villain in this book. And I adore my mother, but she was super unhelpful in this period. And continues to not, I'm not in contact with my mom, which is a huge shame because she's incredible, but she couldn't be part of it. And for her own reasons that I don't even fully understand. And that hurt me enormously. But I had originally written a draft of the book that, like, the first final draft of the book, had nothing about my mom in it, and it was obvious that there was a glaring gap somewhere. The reader was like, there's something huge missing in the story, what is it? And I was like, I can tell you exactly what it is. So I rewrote the book so that it had those scenes with my mom, which are terrible and damning and speak so much to the tension and secrets inside families. When you name abuse, it looks so plain and obvious. And, of course, I played a role in being codependent inside those relationships. It's terrible that way. But I also wanted to make sure that even the people who should be there the most for you and aren't are sometimes doing you a favor. And I'm hoping that my mom was doing me a favor by staying away. So that's the role of the postscript, which sort of retroactively explains some of what we see in the book and why. So yeah, it was a catharsis, and then it was also a deliberate act of literature. I didn't want to write a and then kind of book. This is deliberately an act of literature.
I can't wait to read it. I'm gonna get one very, very soon.
I hope you could consider listening to the audiobook. I am the reader on the audiobook.
Okay.
And my friends who have listened to the audiobook have universally loved how I rendered. Like, I've had to do a lot of my friends and family's voices. And people who know each other are like, wow, that sounds just like Lumiera, or whatever. And so they got very excited at my intonation and my capture of these people.
Great. How are you going to continue the journey? And if so, how are you going to take this wonderful experience and help others?
Well, that's a great question. I have not been asked that before, but I love the opportunity to answer it. So, for example, I gave a presentation, a workshop today to physiotherapists at a local clinic here in Calgary, and it was about the Doman philosophy and putting the patient and the family centered in what they're doing. Our experience with the conventional therapy system was, it was, okay, well, try this and try this, and if it's not working, then don't work too hard. I mean, it'll come. And I was like, no, you have to look at this a different way. The only thing between the kid and ruin is you and the parent. And so your role, you're doing sacred work, and you are a leader. And so anyway, I also talk, like, for free all the time, every single day, on the internet to parents of other Kleefstra syndrome children, parents of children who have been to the institute, and mothers who have contacted me since they've read the book. Like, I see that as a part of my mission now. If I was going to give away my career, I have to make it mean something. Because I really loved my career, and I was really good at it. So it has to mean something that I lost all that, aside from Alexander, who is going to be, of course, my lifetime achievement. You know, like, Al and I are heading off into the sunset together forever, and this kid is going to increasingly have his own impact on the world, independent from me. And so, I mean, part of what I do is I tell his story unselfconsciously as I can, because I'm extremely privileged to have the opportunity to tell the story. I'm very connected to the writing world in Canada, the journalistic writing whole milieu of publishing in Canada. My husband is a prominent writer here, and like, it's my job I lost everything, even myself, inside this fight chronicled hurt, but because I couldn't accept it, and I couldn't find my way through it. And after an apocalypse, what have I got to lose? I might as well tell the truth. I might as well put myself at the front of the fight. I might as well be the person who anybody else can throw, bring their rotten fruit at, because I am strong enough now. I've gone through the fire. My son has achieved vastly more than he was ever going to accomplish. And he's safe now. He can travel on his own now. He can speak. He can answer questions. He can read. I'm here to say, I'm here on the other side, and I'll help you. I'll help you be a bridge. So I see this as my life's work now.
God bless you, and God bless you. Let me ask you this. How if Joel, you have a son, how does he interact with Alexander?
So Sloan is our older child, who is 4 years older than Al. So Al is turning 12 on Tuesday. Sloan is 16. And Sloan and Al have, like, a sibling relationship, right? Like, you know, Sloan's a bit too hard on Al. And, like, you know, like, she flips them upside down on the bed and drops them. And, like, we've got lots of pictures from over the years of him, Alexander, being browbeaten by his older sibling. But also, I mean, I have pictures of them reading together. Sloan takes Alexander to the Sloan part of the therapy and, like, his programming. And so for at least an hour a day, they go to the river together. For at least half an hour a day, they read together. I mean, that's just since COVID. But Sloan has a completely different reality, because Sloan's life has been entirely, except for the first 4 years, entirely characterized by the fact that there was this huge undertaking going on all around Sloan, directed at his brother, right? And so Sloan understands it as a non-negotiable, but also understands that we work extremely hard to give Sloan alone time. Sloan has been on exchange to Germany. Sloan just got back from an exchange to Barrie, Ontario. Sloan is in French immersion. Sloan is on the provincial baseball team, has a skateboard, things that Alexander will never be able to accomplish. And we support Sloan in those things, too. So how do they relate? Really well. Are they normal siblings? In some ways, absolutely. And in some ways, no, because Alexander cognitively can't cut into a conversation with a pun, you know, but periodically he's listening all the time, and he can cut in sometimes, and we'll all be floored, and Sloan will go, yeah, ow, you know?
Yeah. Wait. Yeah. Okay. No. My favorite question of all. Are you ready? What is the answer to the question I should have asked?
What is the answer to the question of what?
That I did not ask.
Oh, what's the answer to the question you did not ask? I don't know. What question didn't you ask?
I'm asking you.
Oh, okay. I think that one of the things that I would love to have mentioned is that having a disabled child can take an incredible toll on your marriage. And there are horrifying statistics of the impact of, and characterized as the disabled child having this impact. It's not the disabled child. It's the fact that society does not come together, does not support the family, does not recognize this as something that we collectively need to address. So it's the marriage put under all this pressure of extra needs and more costs without a commensurate recognition that the marriage is under huge strain and requires outside support. I mean, people come together when spouse has cancer, or if a child gets a broken leg, or something even temporary, like somebody's been in the hospital, or whatever. But when it's an ongoing situation, people are like, well, surely their family's doing something, and their family's like, I don't want to be stuck with this. I have to stay further away. Realistically, the way society runs right now in Canada, we look at disabled kids and adults as being fundamentally worth less than neurotypical or able-bodied adults. And to that end, I would point at the AISH monthly payment, which is between $1,200 and $1,600 a month, I'm sure you're aware. And when the pandemic locked down the country, what did the federal government decide was the bottom, the baseline of what an adult Canadian required to live through a month? Well, it was a great deal more than $1,200 a month, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And if you just look at that, you're looking right in the face of the society's value put on the dignity of families with disabled children and the pressure that a marriage can go through. There's so much unresolved trauma and unnecessary trauma baked into the fact that your costs explode and your social network collapses and your income changes. And that would break anybody. I'm amazed I'm still married. I mean, I'm still married because my husband is amazing. I lost my marbles. And what I mean by that is I was not cognizant of the reality of what was in front of me. My executive function was damaged by the amount of stuff I was trying to keep straight, not just with the program, but with the bureaucratic paperwork, the meetings, the appointments, the financial stress. I went for 2 years wearing pants that had holes in the middle, in the inner thighs, because I couldn't afford to buy new pants. I couldn't afford to buy new pants, and so I was wearing worn-out pants. And there's no dignity in being a 42-year-old woman wandering through the grocery store with your thighs hanging up. You look homeless. And we think even less of the homeless. But there's no recognition. There's no point of no return where people go, okay, let's step in. There's just very piecemeal assistance that will be given, and then you have to provide due diligence and documentation for every dollar. It's ridiculous the amount of scrutiny that families under enormous strain are put under to account for. Why is the public purse assisting us, the most vulnerable? I think that that's disgusting.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, my son can't go to school anymore. Aside from the fact that the previous principal made it a very unwelcoming environment for him. Jason Kenney cut all the aid to school last year. So the online environment became something that we had to oversee every single second. And the school was making a hash of it. And then in September, he was expected to go back to school. I'm immunocompromised. He's immunocompromised. Our older child wanted to go back to school. So we pulled Alexander out of school, and I drove him across Canada in a crappy camper. And while we were driving across Saskatchewan, I realized he had lost his timetable. So he went into kindergarten knowing the first half of his timetable, he could read. His printing was fairly good, small but fairly good. still. This gigantic printer doesn't know his timetable top two anymore and won't read aloud when requested. He's a great guy. Like, what have they been doing with him?
Yeah.
Anyway, so I've got lots and lots and lots to say, but I would say that, you know, marriage, if this UCP government wants to look at marriage as the backbone of civilization and that women should be in the home, blah, 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 all the misogynist bullshit that goes on underneath the policy decisions that are ultimately, you know, erasing women's workforce gains over the last 30 years. And they expect us to absorb everything that's happening during the pandemic and in society generally and in the economy. I mean, there needs to be some recognition that eventually people can't absorb anymore. And that's when we end up with tragedies like families who age out of the youth system and single parents trying to deal with these children, they end up killing themselves. I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. People are extremely isolated.
Yeah. You're right. I admire your fight.
Where
did you get that?
Oh, I got it from my mom.
Okay.
Got it from my mom.
Do you think that fence will ever be mended?
I'm sorry, do I think that what?
You and your mom might have a cup of coffee one day together.
I would love to. I mean, I've seen my mom throughout the writing process. I did see my mom. I helped her move into her new house. I was talking to her on the phone. I mean, it's been strange between us since she checked out at the beginning of Alexander's life, but I still sort of did my duty by her as a child. But last November, I was traveling across Canada with my son, and I was in Barrie, and I was experiencing abdominal pain, and it was like, this is really bad. And in the end, I was having internal bleeding and nearly bled to death in the Barrie hospital. I was in hospital for 7 days and had a couple of different surgeries. I have a bunch of different health issues that contributed to that. But as I was heading into hospital, I had a sense that it was very bad, and I told my mom, listen, this is how you're portrayed in the story. I want you to know that I talk about this incident, and that this has been extremely difficult for me. And she said, that didn't happen, that's not true. And I was like, well, I guess you can just, you and I both know that these things did happen, but you can at least rest assured that I set myself up as an unreliable narrator, so you can fall back on that. Unfortunately, I had a great mentor at the Banff Center who said, it doesn't have to be true. It's not the truth with capital letters. It's just what happened. The truth is subjective. The what happened is something that can be honest. And so I told the what happened to me. My mom's intentions or what happened on her side can be absolutely different. And that's the antithesis of what happened to me. My sister's very angry at me. She's going to have to die mad, I guess. You know, like, unfortunately, they just weren't that supportive. They weren't supportive in a way that could help what was happening to me. And I can only imagine that they stand by how they acted, too. And so, I mean, I'm a forgiver. Life is long and hard, and everybody carries with them unresolved trauma. And I think that we could do with a lot more kindness.
How are you celebrating Mother's Day?
So, My husband, Chris Turner, is going to Nova Scotia to pick up Alexander. And as it happens, I have never had a Mother's Day. Inevitably, Turner is out of town on Mother's Day. That's my husband. So he's always out of town on Mother's Day. And the one year that he wasn't out of town on Mother's Day was the year that Alexander was born on Mother's Day. So, yeah. I never get Mother's Day.
Okay. Well,
I can say this. My husband is bringing my son home.
Yeah. And that's the best gift there is.
It is. I can't wait for him to come home, especially with the weather like this. We go to the river every single day to throw rocks. And he does the environment D, but he also throws rocks for at least an hour. So we spend a lot of each day outside. And that's inevitably good for your soul.
Thank you for sharing your time. Send any comments to camcam@camtait.com. For more information on My Own Blood, visit ideas from camtait.com, please.
DQ presents. Picture this. Picture the new DQ Summer Blizzard treat menu with iconic flavors that taste like instant summer. You order the one and only drumstick blizzard with peanuts. Oh, wow. Crunchy waffle cone pieces, world-famous DQ soft serve, and blue sky bliss. Or maybe you get the brownie batter blizzard. Ooh-wee. Fudgy brownie goodness. You're feeling breezy and dreamy all over. Moments like these are why the new DQ Summer Blizzard treat menu exists. Get it delivered at DQ.com. DQ. Happy tastes good. DQ presents... Picture this. Picture the new DQ Summer Blizzard treat menu with iconic flavors that taste like instant summer. You order the one and only drumstick blizzard with peanuts. Oh, wow. Crunchy waffle cone pieces, world-famous DQ soft serve, and blue sky bliss. Or maybe you get the brownie batter blizzard. Ooh-wee. Fudgy brownie goodness. You're feeling breezy and dreamy all over. Moments like these are why the new DQ Summer Blizzard treat menu exists. Get it delivered at DQ.com. DQ. Happy tastes good.